verses 16 through 30. This is the word of the Lord. As we were going to the place of prayer, we were met by a slave girl who had a spirit of divination and brought her owners much gain with fortune telling. She followed Paul and us, crying out, "These men are servants of the Most High God, who proclaim to you the way of salvation." And this she kept doing for many days. Paul, having become greatly annoyed, turned and said to the Spirit, "I command you in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her." And it came out that very hour. But when her owners saw that their hope of gain was gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace before the rulers. And when they had brought them to the magistrates, they said, "These men are Jews, and they are disturbing our city. They advocate customs that are not lawful for us as Romans to accept or practice." The crowd joined in attacking them, and the magistrates tore the garments off them and gave orders to beat them with rods. And when they had inflicted many blows upon them, they threw them into prison, ordering the jailer to keep them safely. Having received this order, he put them into the inner prison and fastened their feet in the stocks. About midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the prisoners were listening to them. And suddenly there was a great earthquake, so that the foundations of the prison were shaken. And immediately all the doors were opened, and everyone's bonds were unfastened. When the jailer woke and saw that the prison doors were open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself, supposing that the prisoners had escaped. But Paul cried with a loud voice, "Do not harm yourself, for we are all here." And the jailer called for lights and rushed in. And trembling with fear, he fell down before Paul and Silas. Then he brought them out and said, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" This is the word of the Lord. Begins with an unclean spirit proclaiming the truth about Paul and Silas. "These men are servants of the Most High God who proclaim to you the way of salvation." And our passage ends with an unclean man asking these same servants, "What must I do to be saved?" And though Paul rebukes the unclean spirit, he does not rebuke the unclean man. In both cases, he brings deliverance. In the one, to the slave girl, by driving out the unclean spirit who oppressed her. And in the other, to the jailer, by proclaiming to him the word of the Lord and the way of salvation. This question that the jailer asks, it is the great question. The question that we all must ask, the question that we all must have answered. And though it is one question, there are 1,000 different answers that may be offered. But however many answers are given, there is only one answer that is right. And so it matters not only that we ask,
It also matters whom we ask. For that one answer, that one right answer, it has been entrusted to the apostles. The answer has been entrusted to the apostles by the very one who is its answer, which is Christ. Some will say, believe in this, and others, follow that. But he says, believe in me. Follow me. And so his apostles say, believe in him. Follow him. This answer that was entrusted to the apostles, it has been delivered to us that we may receive it by faith. That we may cherish it in love, that we may live by it and have life by it. Yet we would not do justice to what is here written if we only focused our attention upon the question that is asked and the answer that is given. We are often tempted to imagine that as long as we have the right answer, nothing else matters. As long as we know the truth, everything else may be overlooked. But here we find that it is not so. It matters not only that we know the truth, or even that we proclaim the truth. It matters also the way in which that truth is held, the way in which that truth is proclaimed. Now, how is it that we see in this passage that both matter, not only the proclamation of the truth, but also the way in which it is proclaimed? We see it in verse 30. For there the jailer asks Paul and Silas, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" Of course, here we are very concerned with what he has asked. But we should not neglect to consider something else. Why has he asked it? What was it that prompted the jailer to ask such a question? So this evening, we are not as concerned with what he has asked, but why he has asked it. And when we answer that question, why he has asked his question, when we answer that question, we find that what matters is not only the answer that is given, but why it was sought in the first place. And if we had to answer that question in a single word, we could do no better than this: joy. It is joy prompts the jailer's question. But not just any joy. Joy in the midst of suffering. The joy of Christ. Now, we said before that we see in this story of Paul and Silas the story of Christ. The things that happened to them reflect the things that happened to him. And so we see in these verses their union with Christ. We see in these verses their conformity to Christ. Here we see them sharing in the sufferings of Christ. We see it in Paul's casting out of the unclean spirit, for he casts it out with the very authority of Christ. But we see it not only in that act of his casting it out, but also in what motivated him to cast it out, which we said before was not annoyance, but grief. As Christ was grieved for his people, so Paul was grieved for this girl. And what did Paul gain by this work of deliverance? The very thing that Christ gained. Not thanks. An uproar. The uproar of a crowd crying out to the authorities against him. Though he had done nothing wrong, though he had brought deliverance and freedom and peace to one who was enslaved and oppressed, yet still he was condemned. But there were those who stood to profit from that enslavement and oppression. Those who were unable to consider anything but their own privilege and comfort. Not hesitating to use others for their own gain. They were enraged by this one who came to set the captives free. And what they did to Christ, they do here to Paul and also to Silas. They strip them of their garments. They beat them with rods. They inflict upon them many blows. And they throw them into prison, binding their feet in stocks, or more literally, binding their feet to the tree. In all these things, we see Paul and Silas united to Christ. In all these things, we see them conformed to Christ. We see them sharing in the sufferings of Christ. Notice, we do not only hear Christ upon their lips. We see him. We see him in the compassion of their hearts. We see him in the humiliation of their nakedness. We see him in the wounds upon their backs. We see him in the bruises upon their flesh. We see him in the binding of their feet. We do not only hear Christ proclaimed from them. We see Christ displayed in them. And see how he is displayed. What do we expect to hear?
someone when he has been falsely accused of wrongdoing.
What do we expect to hear from one when he has been falsely condemned? When he has been falsely imprisoned? What do we expect one to do when, though he has done nothing wrong, and more than this, when he has done what is right? What do we expect him to do when he has been humiliated, when he is stripped naked, when he is beaten again and again and again? Would we blame him if he raised his voice in lamentation? Would we fault him if he declared his innocence or cried out against those who so beat him? For truly, in all of that, he would not have been wrong to do so. And there are times when it may even be necessary to do so. This has not even come as something of a great surprise. If those who were treated in this way did not cry out in despair, but instead sang for joy. This is the very thing that Paul and Silas did. They've been publicly humiliated. Having been shamefully abused, we do not find them weeping. We find them singing. We do not find them full of sorrow. We find them full of joy. Praying, singing hymns to God. Do you wonder why the prisoners were listening? Who are these madmen who were brought in here, beaten as criminals, now rejoicing before their God? Even in the midst of suffering, even in the midst of great pain, they are not kept from worshiping him. They are not kept from committing themselves to him. What is this joy? It is the joy of Christ. It is the joy of the cross, from which he said in the hour of his death, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." And what happened after he breathed his last? There was a great earthquake. One that split the rocks, one that opened tombs. And so it is here. Verse 26, suddenly there was a great earthquake so that the foundations of the prison were shaken. and all the doors were opened, and everyone's bonds were unfastened. But here is a great mystery. But only did Paul and Silas remain. All of the prisoners remained with them.
Why? Why would they remain? Why would they not flee?
We can guess. They were held there. They were captivated by joy. What is this joy? What is this joy that cannot be stripped away with a garment? What is this joy that the beating of rods cannot drive out, that many blows cannot remove? What is this joy that cannot be bound with chains, that cannot be kept with bars? What is this joy that is greater than freedom? A joy that is so great that one need not escape from prison because he is already set free. Is this joy? Is the joy of the Lord. It is the joy of Christ. It is the joy of our salvation. Do you wonder then why the traveler would say, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved? For what else could keep you here but a salvation that is better than freedom? A salvation that is better than life. Let me know the salvation. Let me know this joy. What is its way? What must I do to be saved?" See, it matters not only what we say. Of course, it matters what we say. It matters not only what we say, but also how we say it. It is not only the words of our mouth that matter. Of course, the words of our mouth matter. Yet it is not only the words of our mouth that matter, but also the way of our life. The church has been given the words of life. Why have they been given?
not only for us to repeat them.
To live by them.
Those words are not the end.
They are a means to an end.
And that end is life.
That end is joy. The church has been given the words of life. But
if we are known by something other than joy,
if we are known by our grumbling,
if we are known by our muttering, if we are known by our irritation, if we are known by our discontentment, if we are known by our grievances, why would anyone want what we have? Why would they suppose to gain what they do not already have?
Because they see your joy,
even in the midst of affliction. A joy that brings you to worship even in the midst of sorrow. Will they not then wonder? Will they not then say, what must I do to be saved? Amen.